So if you're visiting and you haven't been with us, we've been going through Genesis chapter 1 and 2, and now we're in Genesis chapter 3 as we look at the fall. And we look at this passage this morning, which is in many ways discouraging. It's not a very uplifting, joyful, woo-hoo, can't wait to hear that one again. Instead, it's going to be one of those which is going to be like, wow, you mean to tell me this is what we get? But in the midst of that, the reality is this: there is a hope, and the hope, as we've sung this morning, is Jesus Christ. We are called as a people to be joyful, content, to be peaceful. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, right? Galatians 5:22. And Paul writes to the Thessalonians, when he writes to them, the church there, he says, rejoice always. And in Philippians 3:1, Paul says, finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. As believers, we are called to be joyful. How hard is it for you this morning? How much joy do you have? Did you show up this morning thinking, I can't wait to hear about Christ? I can't wait to hear about the gospel. I can't wait to hear what God has for me. I want to hear what God is doing. Or did you show up this morning like I did? With all kinds of things going on in my mind that I was discouraged greatly about. I spent this morning, every Sunday morning, I'm in prayer. Every Sunday morning in prayer, God, please, please, please work. Do what only you can do. And I can tell you from that moment on, after I had my breakfast, there was a constant bombardment in my mind of things I was discouraged about. Just being honest. I had to fight this morning for joy. And I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you, Logan, for what we sang this morning. Because as I sang it, I was filled with joy. And I'm sorry if my hands were in your way. I'm sorry. I can't help but raise my hands. Why? Because there's so much grace and mercy in Christ. There's so much to be joyful about. And I pray for this church. I pray as a church, and some of you visitors, so, you know, just if it applies to you, great, but I'm speaking to our church members mainly. We have a tough time being joyful. This church, we can be friendly. Friendly is not joyful per se. Don't make those synonymous. There's going to be a lot of friendly people, okay? The South is a friendly place, in generically speaking. But I'm talking about joy, where you see on people's faces that they're happy to see you. And that they're happy to be in God's place with God's people. For some reason, that is a challenge in this congregation. And I'm not sure why, except for this. We live in a world in which there's a lot of sorrow, a lot of pain, and a lot of struggle. Right? There's a lot of struggles. There's a lot of challenges in our life on a day-to-day basis. Right? Am I right? Or all of you just in fairy tale land? I'm not. I know you're, and you're not either. None of us are. We are dealing with real challenges. We are dealing with real pain. And the reality is when we come to a place like this, we need hope. And the greatest hope that we have as believers is that we are no longer God's under his condemnation. God's wrath no longer abides on any believer thanks to the atoning work of Jesus Christ. So no matter what challenges you have this morning, we are not like those who have no hope. Our hope is as real as the chairs that you're sitting on. Our hope is in Christ. So that should be our primary reason for being joyful this morning. Christ. And I would argue this, the reason that the joy is not coming as it should is this: your mind is not set on Christ. That's the reality. Because if your mind was set on Christ, eventually, as you sing these songs, as you hear the Romans 8, You can't help but say, praise be to God, because this will not last. There's something far greater. Well, there's a second reason that we should be joyful, and it's far under the reality of salvation, and it's this. We should be joyful because it relates to where we live and the privileges we share this morning that many in the world do not have. Brothers and sisters, I don't believe for a moment you understand how good we have it now. You don't. We have brothers and sisters all around the world who this morning got up and had nothing to even consider in regards to food. Some woke up with absolutely nothing over their heads. There was not a vehicle. They walked miles to church. And yet here we are with all the pleasures, the physical pleasures, the material blessings that God has given us, and yet we still complain. We have hundreds of toys and things that we can distract ourselves with. We have all kinds of good things. Well, after we finish this morning, we are going to eat good food. We have the privilege of being in this facility, which by standards of the world is the Taj Mahal. The reality is we have so much, and yet we're still not joyful. All we do is we look at what we do not have. It's a problem. God has graciously given us a beautiful place to live and many, many comforts. Yet despite these realities, sin's corruption still hinders our joy. So, what can we not escape? I want to give you, real quickly, seven things, just briefly, to think about in regards to the consequence of sin. Because here is where the struggle comes in. Here's the struggle. Here I am saying, be joyful! And then I'm going to say, here's the consequence of sin. Here's our struggle. Number one, consider these realities. Diseases mar and handicap hundreds and thousands of people. Disease everywhere. You can't get away from it. 2 weeks ago, my best friend and mentor finds out he has a brain tumor. Have no idea how long he has to live. We talk about death all the time. Little did he know at 59 that he would be struck with a brain tumor. We have people that are in our congregations whose parents are struggling with diseases. We have people in our congregation whose children will suffer, if not already are suffering with things. Disease, the breakdown of the body, it's all around us. What about mental? We don't even talk about the mental part of it, do we? Well, what was on the headlines this week? Robin Williams and his suicide? What was that all about? It's the reminder of this, that there are people all around us who are suffering mentally. Secondly, marriages struggle. Marriages struggle, and many, unfortunately, end in divorce. Marriages all around us are struggling greatly. And many end in divorce. Three, children break the hearts of their parents. Children break the hearts of their parents because of terrible and sometimes tragic decisions. And I'm talking about children not here necessarily all the time. I'm talking about children who grow up and you have all these hopes and dreams that they will follow Christ and they don't follow Christ and their marriages are shambles. Their lives are shambles and a mom's heart breaks. And they come in every Sunday realizing that's not what I wanted for my child. And they're crying out to God, please help. What about the dreams that are shattered and hopes that are never fulfilled? We have people all around us have these dreams. And their dreams are shattered, having no idea when that would come and why that happened. And they come into our churches looking for hope. What about the struggle? This is number 5, by the way. I'm giving you this list because I just want you to think. These are just a few. We go on and on and on. What about the struggle against our sinful inclinations that are sometimes paralyzing and lifelong? Addiction is a paralyzing struggle that is lifelong. Yes? Addictions to all sorts of things, brothers and sisters. And it is paralyzing, and it's as if they can never get that victory, and it never, never ends. What do they need? They need the hope of the gospel. What about those, number 6, who are seeking out pleasure, yet pleasure is fleeting, and all material gain cannot ultimately satisfy? There are people who are trying to fill their lives with things that cannot satisfy. Finally, the last one is this. Last one is this. It's the biggest one on the radar screen. It should be the biggest one on your radar screen. And it's this last reality. Death comes to all. You're not going to escape. No one gets out alive, as they jokingly say at the base. I hear the guy say, no one gets out alive. Death comes to all, and for some, it comes earlier than expected. Life is but a vapor. It appears for a little while, and then it vanishes. The reality is this: death is coming. And we who are in that conveyor belt of corpses, because you're on that conveyor belt, you're going to be on that conveyor belt. The question becomes is, what have you put your hope and confidence in? Now, let me ask you a question. After I gave you that list, let me ask the question again. How are you going to have joy? After that list, you can't, whoa, yeah, this is a happy message. Woo! Well, on that note, I think we'll leave now and go have lunch. No. The question can only be answered in light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. This morning, we are going to look at the consequence of Adam and Eve's sin, particularly how it affected the woman and how it impacted the man. This morning, as we look at that, we're going to realize it is a tragic and sobering and discouraging truth. But as we look at the consequences, we must keep this in mind. God has not left any of us alone. Remember what we sung, "He will hold me fast"? Do you believe that? He will hold me fast. When I get the news that I don't have a few months to live, my marriage is falling apart, my children are deserting the faith, He will hold me fast. In a sinful and corrupt and discouraging world, there is a hope. And the believer's hope is found in what is to come. If you this morning are setting your hope on the things of this world, you will eventually find it comes to nothing. Nothing. God had promised Adam and Eve in Genesis 2:17 that if they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they would surely die. And they would die. But there will also be other consequences to their disobedience. Last week, we saw the implications of God's curse on Satan. Now God turns his attention to Eve first and then to Adam. God addressed them by the role they played in their disobedience. This is fascinating. When God first comes to Adam and Eve, he goes to Adam first to ask the question. Then he asks Eve the question. Now in passing judgment, he reverses this role. The first person he goes to is Satan or the serpent. And he curses the serpent. Then he goes to Eve. And then finally he turns his attention to Adam. I want us to begin this morning by looking at God's judgment on the woman. Now some have said this is the curse or this is the judgment. God doesn't actually curse the woman. God doesn't actually curse the man. He curses the serpent. And he also curses the ground. But there is consequences here, and I want us to see it. Look, if you would, at verse 16. Genesis chapter 3, verse 16. Look at the text. God says to Eve, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. So God doesn't curse Adam or Eve. However, he does pronounce judgment on her. And we see it in two areas. First of all, we see it in the area of childbearing. And secondly, we see it in her relationship with her husband. It is important that we realize that God's statements here to her and to the man are judicial. They have sinned, and now they must bear the consequence. And hear me, please hear this. This is huge. If you don't hear this, you'll miss it. The judgment is always there, but there is a remedy to the judgment. And in every case, as we look at this, we need to ask the question, what is the remedy? And the answer every time is this: the gospel. Jesus Christ is the answer to all of these judgments. And we're going to flesh that out a little bit, but I want us to see the judgment first and to see how it impacts Adam and Eve. First, pain and childbearing. The first consequence for Eve is found in bearing children. God told her that he would, look at the word, I will multiply your pain and childbearing. Now, every woman in here who has had children or born children knows this. Yeah? Some of you say, praise God for epidurals. Right? That's what I've just heard. Why? Because of the pain. The pain and childbearing. I said it last week. It is very ironic that the means by which God would deliver his people from Satan is the very means that would be painful to the woman. What I mean by that is God said through her seed, his head would be crushed. Satan's head, right? But the only way for Satan's head to be crushed was through the seed of the woman. Well, how is the woman to produce an offspring through childbearing? And it's through this process that God says it will be painful. Painful labor was the result, but I think there's more to that. Last night I was talking to my children, and I said, you know what else that's included in this childbearing process? It doesn't stop at birthing children. Here it comes, you know this, the pain continues as you raise the child. I told my children that last night, and they're like scratching their heads, like, what's Dad saying? We're pain? Pain in the neck? No, what I'm saying is children are sinful creatures. Yes? And in their sin, they are to be raised, and they're supposed to be disciplined, and there's probably more pain sometimes in raising a child than just the delivery. Although that's a very painful process. There is this labor, there's this hardship in raising children as well. Raising children, and you know this, I'm not telling you something you don't know, but raising children can be emotionally and physically exhausting. I get no amens out of that. It's amazing. We have a room full of children. Understand. Too often we think this term and text of having the child, which is true, childbearing, but raising sinful, self-willed children is also a struggle. It is a struggle. It will always be a struggle. And can I say this? As long as you are a parent, and even though your children may leave the house, if you were to have a child who is not following Christ, the pain is always there, knowing that what? Your child does not yet know the Lord. The only remedy to the struggle of raising children is the gospel. Here's how. Paul says in Ephesians 6:4, bring up your children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. You know what your children need more than anything, parents? They need the gospel day in and day out. They don't need to know how to have a great career. Their biggest need is not to figure out if they can do the math. I know that's important. They need the discipline. I'm talking about they need the gospel. They need the gospel every day. Dads, hear me. Are you teaching the gospel to your children every day in some way, shape, or form? Are you reminding your children Christ is the answer? This is the only way this remedy for disobedience and heartbreak is going to be applied. Your children need the gospel. Your children don't need to know what it is to be a good moral person. There's a lot of good moral people out there. There's Muslims that have morals. There's Mormons that have morals. There's Jehovah's Witnesses that have morals. They need Christ. Your house ought to be a place where they are hearing over and over again the gospel of Jesus Christ. That is what your children need. And listen, if your children are grown, it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. Your children and your grandchildren need to hear the gospel. I believe that's what Paul meant when he said that the discipline and instruction of the Lord. What he's saying is children need to understand what God says about their nature and who they are, and they need Christ as the remedy. Are your children getting the remedy of the gospel? The mother's need is this, to remind herself of the gospel as well. Mothers, I'm going to say this, mothers. There's mothers in here have lots of children. We have children. Praise be to God we have children. I'll explain that later. We're probably not going to get through this sermon this morning. It's going to be part two next week. And the reason it is because I just want to think, all the children in this room, mothers, you know how hard it is and how discouraging it can be when you tell your children time and time again and nothing seems to sink in. Can I tell you what's happening? The Holy Spirit has yet to apply that weight on the Lord. Trust the Lord. Wait on the Lord. Realize that God will not allow His word return void. Tell your children time and time again with grace. Tell your children time and time again with mercy and love. God has done this for you. And remind them that and trust God that He will use it. Brothers and sisters, it is hard. It is hard work raising children. But can I say this? I'll say this. How patient is He with you? How patient is God with you? How patient is He? I was praising God this morning for being patient with me. You know why? Because I realized that all this joy that was being snatched away based on my own sinful thoughts and my attitude was this. That is sin. That is sin. And yet God was merciful and gracious to me to remind me of His gospel. It's what you need. So childbearing, raising children. So if one of our couples is going to get married and you have another couple soon to have a baby, you're all excited. That's good. It'll be painful. I hope your parents and your grandparents are being honest with you and will tell you, oh, there's so much joy, but there is heartache. I remember many times, and you've heard the saying, when they're young, they trample on your feet, and when they're older, they will trample on your heart. It's a possibility. Some of you don't think it's a possibility because you're doing all the right things. Can I tell you something? It doesn't matter if you do all the right things. Unless God gets hold of their heart, they will walk away from God. That's why the gospel. Second is this consequence. You say, well, can we stop there? That's enough, right, women? That's enough, please. He gave you the one consequence. That's enough. That's enough. So I'm sorry, there's another area. It's the conflict with her husband. Oh, do we have to go there? Look what it says. There's a second consequence in regards to Eve, and it negatively affects Adam. We read, "Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." When we think of desire, we think in terms of wanting something. And on the surface, it would appear that God is saying that woman will want her husband. Some have even suggested that this is a reference to sexual desire. But sexual desires are not a curse. I say it again, sexual desires are not a curse. That's a good thing. Sex is by God. It's glorious in the context of marriage. For a woman to desire a husband would be a good thing. But in this context, it's negative. So how would this be a consequence? Desire here can also be an act of control. We find this in Genesis chapter 4. To understand this text, look if you would at Genesis chapter 4. Cain is angry with Abel because God had accepted Abel's offering, but not Cain's. And God confronts Cain. And he confronts Cain in Genesis chapter 4, verse 6. Look at what is said in this context. Here's God, Genesis 4, verse 6. "The Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it.'" That's not a positive thing. It's not positive at all. Here is what God is saying to Eve. When God says to Eve, "Your desire shall be for your husband," he is saying that she will want to master or control him as much as she can. This is the source of conflict with her husband. What we see here is the marriage alone will never give a woman what she ultimately wants. And you know why this is ironic? Because marriage was intended to be what the woman needed. To be his helper, to submit to him, and to follow his leadership. Now, in that context, you've got to understand something here. Sin has infected all aspects of what? The relationships. So when we talk about this, sin has now impacted man, the husband. He wants to live for himself, right? She wants to live for herself. But in this conflict, God is saying to her, "Your desire is going to want to master him. You'll want to control him." Marriage was intended to be a harmonious partnership, glorifying God together. But she will find that it is another source of struggle because of sin. What was the original purpose of God creating Eve? She was created as a helpmeet. Sin comes into the picture, and now the God-given role of helping him has been marred, not now by her desire to help him, but by her desire to what? Control him. It happens all over. This is not the idea of a woman saying to her husband, here's my advice. It's the woman manipulating him so that she can get what she wants. And if she can't manipulate him, she will make his life so miserable that he will do exactly what she wants. That is judgment. That's exactly what Satan wants. To be this constant conflict between the man and the woman. We wonder why so many marriages are on the rocks. It's because we have a man who doesn't love his wife, and we have a wife who's trying to control her husband, and there's constant battle going on in the heart, going on against one another. And no longer is she allowing him to be the leader, the head of the marriage. Instead, she demands that he submit to her desires. And what will her husband do? Here's what it says. Look at the text again. It says in there, he says, "Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." It's not positive, brothers and sisters. It's not positive. He will do all that he can to control and master her and to put her down. The source of abuse of women goes back to the curse. And by the way, ladies, in this culture, we hear the feminist constant refrain, we want more, we want more. Can I tell you where that comes from? It comes from Genesis chapter 3, verse 16. It is, period. Look at some of the other nations around us. Go to the Middle East. Go to India. Go to Afghanistan. You know what you're going to find there? You're going to find women who are treated worse than animals. Can I tell you where that comes from? It comes from the curse, man putting woman down. It's sin. Absolute sin. In our own culture, here it is. Do we know how it's done in our own culture? Here's how it's done in our culture. You say, well, we don't have women walking around with burkas. We don't have women walking around behind their husbands. No, we allow women to drive. We don't have her sitting in the back seat. Here's how we treat women today in our culture. We make her objects of our lust. And we use her and we abuse her as if it's no big deal. Pornography is the scar on this landscape as we, as men, put women down and make them objects instead of seeing her as a daughter of God, as she truly is. Our author, one author rightly said, in those moments of life's greatest blessing, children and marriage, the woman would now sense most clearly the painful consequences of her rebellion from God. The only solution to the problem is the gospel. The only solution to the problem is the gospel. That's the only solution. It is being able to say, it's not about me. It's the woman saying, I want to glorify God. It's the man saying to his wife, we are going to worship God together. I'm going to love you as a daughter of God. It's the woman saying, my role is not to control my husband. My role is not to sit there and make him do what I want. My role is to submit to him as God would call me to submit to him and to submit to his headship and pray for him and pray that he makes the decisions that would bring glory to Christ. Only the gospel will change that, brothers and sisters. The reason our marriages, if they are in struggle, if they are in pain and turmoil, is because Christ is not at the center. That's the main reason why our marriages are not what they're supposed to be, is because Jesus Christ is not at the center. And many times, I'll put the responsibility in the man's lap. Because it's your responsibility, husbands, to love your wives and point them to Jesus Christ. To be patient with them. To desire that they grow in Him. The gospel applies. And the gospel will only change those broken and marred relationship. Every marriage, no matter how good it is, every marriage is in need of grace. Without that grace, the curse of sin dominates that relationship. For you young people here, might be in the teens, wherever, somewhere in there, as you think about a future spouse, I will not deal with the courtship dating thing. I don't care if it's courtship. I don't care if it's dating. I really don't. It doesn't matter to me. What young people need to understand first and foremost is that, number one, you are first and foremost pursuing Christ with all your life. And when God does bring that individual into your life, the primary thing that you should be considering is, does that person have that same pursuit that you have? Do they love Jesus Christ with all their heart, soul, strength, and mind? I can tell you, you can know that by the individual. You can know it. And for you parents, how's your spouse? Tell me this. How is your children ever going to know who to choose anyway if they don't have a mom and dad displaying that? And you sit there and you worry about your children, who they're going to choose. Well, let me ask you, dads, are your girls seeing you as an example of a gospel-centered father? And wives, are your children seeing you as a gospel-centered mother where Christ is utmost in your relationship with him and with each other? I want my children to see Christ in me and the way I relate to my wife. And loving her and thanking her and laying down my life for her. Because I can guarantee if I'm doing that, my girls, Lord willing, by grace, will look for the same kind of man. Because they will have seen it in their father. And they will have seen it in their mother. That's what God's called us to. I want to go on, but I can't. Because if I go on, we'll be here for another half an hour because men... Oh boy, there's a lot more to be said about you. And because of the time, I'm going to hold off for next week. For visitors, if you're from out of town, stay an extra day. Next week, Sunday, whatever it may be. But brothers and sisters, I can't tell you how important this is. This is the understanding. Understanding Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3 is the foundation for the gospel. You must understand the curse and the effects of the curse and what is done to our lives before you can ever understand how Jesus applies the remedy. And if you're here this morning and you've never given your life to Christ and you've never put your faith and trust in Him, you will have absolutely no hope in this life. You can sit there and try to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and I can promise you time and time again, you will never be able to accomplish what God wants you to accomplish. Only Christ can save you. Only God, only Christ can change your heart and change your life and give you a marriage that brings honor and glory to Him. That is our greatest need, to cry out to Jesus, plead for His grace, plead for His mercy, plead that God would change your heart. And by the way, say this one thing. Don't look at your spouse and say it's her fault. Because I'm afraid, here's what I'm afraid of. We closed here. This is not where I wanted to close. I've got a lot of paper here. It's not where I wanted to close. Here's my concern. Some of you men will go out of here and you'll look at your wife. It's not your wife's fault in your response. It's your fault. Do not point fingers. The problem in every person in this room doesn't lie in another person. It lies right here, our own hearts. You need God to change you before your marriage and your relationships can ever be changed. You need your heart transformed.